Ms. Walker, you were born in Birmingham in 1915.
That's correct.
And your father was a Methodist minister.
Yes.
You told...
Two churches in Birmingham.
Was it CME?
Oh, it was...
AME.
No, it was neither. It was what we call them, the main church out of which these had come, the Methodist Episcopal Church.
Today
it's known as United Methodist.
Uh-huh.
But the ME Church was the church that both Richard Allen came out of and the CME.
Was the central jurisdiction of the Methodist Church South.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And but the Methodist Church South in 1939, rejoined the ME
and became
the United Methodist.
Right. You went to high school in Birmingham?
No, my father moved us to New Orleans when I was 10,
uh-huh.
10 years old, and I finished grade school the next year in New Orleans and finished Gilbert Academy in 1930, when I was 14 years old. I was 15 that summer.
Was that a private school?
Yes, it was a Methodist school.
For girls?
No, it was a co-ed. We had a grade school, a model grade school, a high school called Gilbert Academy, and a four-year college.
Uh-huh.
My father taught 1 year in the high school, and then the next year he moved into the college. My mother was the music teacher for the college for 9 years.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had two sisters and one brother. They are still alive.
Older than you or
younger?
Younger.
I'm the oldest.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when did you finish high school?
In 1930.
Okay. You were only 15 years old.
I was only 15 in 1930. I went to college at 15.
Where did you go then? Straight to Northwestern?
No, I went to two years to that school where my mother and father were teaching.
I see.
It was known as New Orleans University, not to be confused
with the present
University of New Orleans.
Right.
But what we know today as Dillard.
I see.
Dillard University.
Sure, which was a Methodist
school.
We had a Methodist background.
Yes, Methodist and a congregational, I think, the American Missionaries.
AMA.
Yeah, American Missionary Association. Strait was American Missionary, and New Orleans University was Methodist.
Uh-huh. Okay,
so
then,
I went there 2 years.
And then you transferred to Northwestern in 32?
In 1932 as a junior. I went from that year of 32 and 33, and then it was really the middle of the Depression. The Depression hit us the hardest there that year.
Right.
And my mother and father were no longer getting checks. They'd get a little bank envelope with a few dollars in it. And I couldn't go back to Northwestern until the following year. I went back in 34. I stayed home a year.
You stayed in New Orleans for
a year. And then in 1934, I went back, and I graduated in 1935.
Okay. Did you stay in Chicago then?
Yes, after graduation.
Graduated?
I practically had to. We didn't have any money. I needed to get a job. I wanted to write and publish my writing. And I had the feeling that if I stayed in Chicago, I'd have a better chance of publishing than if I went back to New Orleans.
And so how long did you end up staying in Chicago?
Altogether until 1939.
So for 4 years after you graduated, you remained in the city?
In Chicago, that's right.
And how much of that time did you work for the Writers Project?
A good 3 years. I was out of college 7 months before I got a job.
Uh-huh.
And I got that job in Chicago on the Writers' Project. As I recall, I got that job early in March of 36. I remember that 1936, I went to the National Negro Congress, the first one.
Uh-huh.
A. Philip Randolph, the president of Stephen Carr Porter's, was the president.
Mm-hmm.
It was a thing that had the labor movement and the radical parties, socialist and communist, trying to pull in young intellectuals.
Right.
And that was the first time I saw Richard Wright.
Uh-huh. At that Congress.
At that Congress.
That was also in Chicago.
That was in Chicago.
Where was it?
Old Armory Building.
Uh-huh.
On the south side.
Yeah.
And I remember I was living on the near north side, near Oak Street. And the people in the church where I had worked in, say, at St. Matthew's Methodist Church, there in what is now Cabrini Green.
Mm-hmm.
Cabrini Green was not in existence then. But that church had a WPA project in it, and it was a recreational project. And I worked with young people in that until I got
the Writers Project job.
Writers
Project. And name again the people who were involved in the Writers Project that you got to be
the prominent who became quite famous were Richard Wright, Nelson Algren, the man with the golden arm.
Right.
Jack Conroy.
Jack Conroy.
And his friend and collaborator, Anna Bonton.
Yeah.
And Willard Motley, Knock on Any Door.
Right. Studs Terkel.
Yeah, Studs Terkel. And he wrote most about Chicago.
Yeah.
And then...
what about James T. Farrell? Was he involved in that?
His wife was on the project, but he wasn't.
He wasn't.
But he came around. Uh-huh. You saw James T. Farrell on that project.
That was a great time for writers in Chicago.
That's
wasn't
right.
It?
Studs Lonergan was one of the books that I read at the time. And then there was Frank Yerby.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize Saul Bellow was Saul Bellow until I saw his picture in Jerry Mangione's book, The Dream and the Deal.
And he was there too during
Saul
that time?
Saul Bellow came on the project,
my gosh,
I think around 1937.
All right, now I want to stop you there. I've got a really important question to ask you at this point. You're Southern,
mm-hmm,
to the bone. You're
mm-hmm
Southern, born and bred,
mm-hmm,
and you're black,
mm-hmm,
and you're
female,
and female, mm-hmm, and you're 20 years old, 21 years old, and you're having this experience in Chicago with all these writers, white and black,
mm-hmm,
and it's a different society.
Entirely.
And you saw things there that you would love to see back home, but they weren't there. Now I want to know, why did you come back?
Well, it was easy in a way for me to think about coming back. Even in Chicago, I had black and white to tell me that I was a little southern bourgeois girl. And
too middle class.
I didn't belong to the working class, which I insisted I was as much a worker as anybody else.
Well, truth was, those guys were not working class people either, those
but
writers.
I was as much that...
you were as much as they were.
That's right.
Yeah.
But a man named Patterson was working... Patterson was a lawyer who worked on the Midwest Record, which was a radical paper. And I guess I went over there to try to get a job. And he said to me, "You don't belong here. You're a little southern bourgeois girl. You don't belong here."
What an insult.
And I looked at him as if to say, "I don't know what you mean," but I didn't say anything to him. Then, Richard Wright said to me one day, "I know where you come from. I have seen in the windows of houses, those houses where you people like you live."
He's pulling a class thing on you, wasn't he?
Class. which I had no knowledge of. It really had never hit me.
Yeah.
But I had a young white girl on the project to say, you went to Northwestern? How could your folks afford to send you to Northwestern? That's a rich white school. She said, my people could never have thought of sending me to Northwestern.
Well, it's a good question. How did it happen?
Well, Northwestern, it was originally a Methodist school.
Uh-huh.
And Methodist ministers could send their children there on rebates.
Ah, I see.
My father, the tuition was $300, I think a semester. My father could send us to Northwestern, my sister and me, almost for $300
for the two of you.
$150 or $60 would pay my tuition.
Wow.
And that meant, and even so, when I graduated, I had a bill there that I had to finish paying before I could get my diploma.
Yeah.
Because my father and mother just had no money.
Yeah.
But one thing I could say, the people at Northwestern never insulted us a day about money, never
uh-huh.
made me even feel embarrassed.
Uh-huh.
But my father had been to school at Northwestern, and so had my mother.
They both had been there.
Had been there. My father took a graduate degree. He took a master's in biblical literature from Garrett Biblical Institute at Northwestern in the 20s. Back in, I think he went 6 summers, and 1 summer he didn't go. I think he went 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29. 1 summer he didn't go, which was, I think, 27 or 28, but he got his master's, and he already had finished done his divinity work and had a college degree.
Did your mother take a degree there also?
No, she did not take a degree, but they offered her a scholarship to come and get her master's in music because she was so talented and did so well in the music courses that she took. They said if she would come and spend a year, she would get her degree. She said she couldn't afford to leave home, that I was just at the age, I was a teenager. I guess I must have been 12 or 13. And she said she couldn't leave her family to go. That was the wrong time to leave us. And so she sacrificed that, and she didn't get the degree.
Yeah.
We always felt sorry that Mama didn't get to do that because we know she would have done well.
Yeah. How many black students were at Northwestern when you were there?
That year, 1932-33, there were 40 black students.
Is that a fact?
And there were 11,000 students altogether in the university. There were 40 of us.
I'm surprised there were that many. I mean, I think of the northern schools as really not doing all that good a job.
And they quickly sent you home. The year that we went there, my sister, Macy Dees, was really a prodigy. She was remarkable in music, and she had almost a straight A average for her 4 years of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And when her records went to Northwestern, she really was eligible for what they had then, they called the prodigy class. And they gave a scholarship for 4 years, but she didn't get it merely because she was black.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give it to her.
Yeah.
And she blamed Mama and the white president in New Orleans for not pushing and getting her to do it, but they couldn't.
Yeah.
And the president of Northwestern at the time was named Walter Dill Scott. And he wrote a letter to Mercy Dees saying that in the entering class, they had some very brilliant people, but there was nobody with an average anywhere like her.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't offer her a scholarship.
Yeah.
And because we didn't have any money, I was the only year my students attended Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
She is bitter about it to this day. She resents it.
Yeah. Mercy Dees?
Mercy Dees.
Mercedes.
Mercedes. Mercedes.
I hear you.
It's Mercedes.
Yeah.
And she when the time came to send her back, she blames me for this. I had finished Northwestern. And before I even could get a job, my sneeze came back to go to school. And nope, we couldn't put her in school because we didn't have any money. So I told my mother, I thought Mason D should go to a professional music school rather than come to Northwestern. That she wanted to be a concert pianist and that she wanted to study music.
Yeah.
And when she came to Northwestern, she was 15, and they said you couldn't come in the school of music unless you were 16. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't let her in the school of music. And I said, well, the thing to do is to send her to Chicago Musical College, which is a professional music school like Juilliard. Mm-hmm. And I said, and see if some of the musicians in New Orleans will help her. And they did. Corrine Meyer, a famous white musician in New Orleans, and Ferdinand Dunkley, an organist for a Jewish church, but probably a Christian Scientist himself. They helped Moshe Deeds. And they asked Rudolph Gans to give her scholarship and give her aid. They gave her work aid. That's the kind of aid they gave her.
Yeah.
I haven't seen
them. I think they went back to the room.
To the cabin. Y'all got it. You're not down there? You may have it, but you interrupted me.
It's all right. So, okay, now I interrupted you a minute ago. You were going
to
tell me how it was easy for... No, we got that. How it was easy for you to go back home.
Oh, it was easy for me to go back home because, first of all my roots were still in the South. My mother and father and my grandmother, my sisters and my brother were living where it was easier for us to live than in Chicago.
You were this was in 39.
The house we were living in, my sister and brother still live in that house. My father moved us in that house in 1925. And
family's been there a long time.
In that house. My grandmother, my father, and my mother all died in that house. We had cousins who came north and didn't come home. Aunts who came up and uncles, they didn't do well at all in the North. They never got any more education. They didn't finish their education. Didn't get as much as we had gotten. They didn't ever own a home. They didn't buy a house. They might have had good jobs and big cars. So it looked to us as if we were better off in the South, even from an economic standpoint, than we were in the North. And we were constantly being told that we were accommodationists because we compromised with Jim Crow and prejudice. We contended that even in Chicago and Evanston there was Jim Crow and prejudice. Black girls couldn't swim in the swimming pool at Northwestern. We couldn't live in the dormitories. We couldn't eat on campus. That was
so you saw plenty of segregation in Chicago.
And refused service in restaurants in Chicago.
So in 1939, you're 24 years old. You ready to go home?
No. I went out to Iowa.
In 39?
In 39.
So from Chicago, you went to Iowa.
I went to Iowa.
Okay, go ahead with that.
I went to Iowa because after I had been on the project 3 years, Congress passed a bill. The country seemed bitterly opposed to the WPA. The politicians were raving and saying you were boondogglers using up the good tax money of the good people of the country. They forgot that these people who were on WPA had been on the relief rolls and had no place, no employment, and that they were painting beautiful pictures and creating books and having plays, and we were having a kind of artistic renaissance in this country. They didn't value that. They thought that if you weren't making money enough to pay Uncle Sam's taxes, you needed to get off of the government payroll. And they passed a law. Congress passed a law that said anybody who had been on one of those WPA projects for as many as 18 months must get off and stay off for an interim of so many weeks or months before they could apply to go back. At that time, I hadn't been on that 18 months, I'd been on that 3 years. I went on the project in 36, and I received a pink slip telling me I was no longer employed in August of 39. And I didn't think about getting a job. I said I wanted to go to school, go to graduate school, where I could prepare myself to go come south and teach. Why would I come south? I couldn't teach in a northern school anywhere.
You couldn't get into a school system up there?
Nobody was going to hire me. There were few black teachers in the public schools of Chicago, very few. And the first woman, black woman principal that I remember was Maud Bousfield. And they made a big to-do of her being a principal of a school. When in New Orleans, there were women that I know from childhood who I'd seen as principals of grade schools. And I wanted to teach in a college. And the chances were, if I taught in a college, it would have to be a black college. And where was I going to find a black college if I didn't go to South? I didn't think about going to Pennsylvania.
Lincoln would be about the only other choice.
I, as I saw it, I knew that there were 17 states in the South, and every one of them had a black college.
That's right, exactly right.
And that...
At least one.
At least one. There were several.
Some states had several. North Carolina had nine. Yeah, a bunch of them.
I said this, that I had grown up literally on a college campus. I was literally born on one. My father and mother taught in Alabama at the school where I was. I was born very close to that school. And that somebody pointed out to me, there's a very great difference. I've learned that too. There's a big difference in the culture of a college town and the culture of a mill town.
Big difference.
And it dawned on me, my mother and my father were products of that kind of community. And I wanted to go south and teach, so I went out to Iowa with no money. Absolutely broke. I had taken the last paycheck that I'd gotten and gotten my diploma from Northwestern, $20. I paid that bill and paid $20 for my diploma and paid for my transcript to go to the University of Iowa. And at the same time, my sister Mercedes, was there in music school where she had been working her way. And she had played with a symphony orchestra in Orchestra Hall at the commencement of Chicago Musical College and won 8 curtain calls, ovations. And that had been in the paper, in the Chicago Tribune and other papers. And I wanted to see her stay in Chicago at least one more year and graduate. And so, what little money that I could rake and scrape, I paid for her room rent for 2 weeks and bought some food for her. And I had $10 out of which I paid my railroad fare to Iowa City. And what I had left was what I ate on for so many days before the woman where I stayed told me, you can start eating here tomorrow. Her niece had seen me look at my change and I had 35 cents. and it wasn't enough to buy another meal.
This was in Iowa City.
Iowa City.
So was it in a black community?
No, I lived in a black home.
Uh-huh.
And it was right down the street from the Capitol. It was on Capitol Street. I did not live in the dormitory. I don't think at that time blacks were living in the dormitory in Iowa. But I lived with Miss Culberson. Frances Culberson lived on Capitol Street. And I lived there a year. I went there in September. And I took my degree in August.
The following year of 1940.
I was 25.
And then you came back to Mississippi.
And then I went to New Orleans, to Louisiana. Where my father was pastoring a little church in Scotlandville, out from Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home, and it took 18 months before I was able to get a job with any kind of wage at all. And I was ill. I got off the train and in a state of collapse. My father lifted me from the train. I weighed 89 pounds. But I had the degree, and
bless
I didn't owe anybody anything.
Bless your heart.
I didn't owe it. And I had lived on one meal
a day. I bet he was proud of you.
Well, in a way he was, but not as proud as he was 2 years later when I won that award.
For
my people. The thesis that I wrote at Iowa was submitted to Stephen Vincent Benet at Yale. For the Yale Young Poets Competition.
And your thesis was poetry.
My thesis was poetry. That's why I went to Iowa.
I see. They
because
had a big...
Anna Bontemps told Vivian Harsh, the librarian at George Cleveland Hall, tell Margaret if she's going to school, go out to Iowa. They have a program out there where you can get your graduate degrees with a creative thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And with her talent, she shouldn't try to do the scholarly thing. Now she ought to do the creative.
That's wonderful.
Both my degrees at Iowa were given with creative.
Okay, you got your bachelor's in 1940?
1935 at Northwestern.
No, okay, well, so your first degree at Iowa was a master's in English in 40.
Mm-hmm.
And then when did you get the PhD?
I went back out there 20 years later, 22 years later.
1960s.
1962,
okay.
I went back.
Okay, I'm gonna come back
there,
to that.
And I stayed there 3 years and got a doctorate. And my dissertation was my novel, Jubilee.
All right. Okay, now I'm gonna come back to that, but let's go back there to 1940 and you came back to Louisiana. It was only a year or two after that you were at Jackson State, wasn't it?
No. My first teaching job was at Livingstone College.
Yeah, right.
18 months after I left Iowa. I left Iowa in August of 40. And I didn't have a job until February of 42.
And where did you work at Livingstone then?
Livingstone College in Salisbury, North Carolina. I tried to get a job at Talladega, and I had an interview with the president, who was then Buell Gallagher. He later came to New York.
Yes,
Buell Gallagher. And he was very, very encouraging and felt very sure that he could get me, hire me at Talladega. But the two women at Talladega were white women in the English department. And they didn't want a black woman. They wanted a black man.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So they showed him why the black man would be better for them, because he had a PhD and I didn't have the PhD. So I didn't get the job at Talladega,
mm-hmm.
which was another disappointment.
Yeah. You went to Livingstone and stayed there how long?
Well, I stayed that second semester. And I worked the part of the summer. Then I went home and discovered that where I had applied in 1940 to West Virginia, they had heard that I'd won the Yale Award, and they wrote to my New Orleans, my Louisiana address, and said they would hire me at West Virginia. West Virginia State.
At Bluefield?
No, at Institute.
Oh, yeah.
Out from Charleston.
Right, yeah.
They said they would pay me $200 a month, and they wanted me to come. My mother and father said they didn't wait for me to get home. They answered and told them I'd be there in September. They accepted the job for me. They felt they could do that because they had that kind of control over their children.
So, and how long did you stay up there then?
Well, I was there one full year. I was there when all my people came out, and there was a big hullabaloo over this black girl winning this Yale Award. And the black papers all had it, and some white papers. And Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., said that it was a rare day to have a prize-winning poet who was a black woman. He named me the Woman of the Year for 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this was such a great honor because I was the first black woman since the 1920s, since the Harlem Renaissance with Georgia Douglas Johnson, to publish a book of poetry that got national critical attention.
Yeah.
And West Virginia said, well, this is just what we want.
Yeah, sure.
But I was gone. I was asked to speak everywhere in neighboring country states. And I was there only, I wasn't there a year. I went up to New York in October, I think. Right after the book was published, I went to New York in November. And I was there Thanksgiving time. Both Stephen Vincent Vinay and Louis Gannett and Irita Van Doren at the New York Herald Tribune had me to read for the New York Herald Tribune's book and author luncheon, which was an event every fall. That really helped to launch me. There was a woman, they tell me there were two distinguished people there. They tell me Wendell Willkie was in the audience and spoke about how much he enjoyed my poetry. And there was a woman named Phyllis Moore. And she sent me a telegram the next day saying, you something to praise my reading the poetry, and said, I would like to have the country hear you. And she had a lecture bureau. She was at 711 Fifth Avenue, where the great, what's the man's name, begins with an H, Saul Hurock was the big entrepreneur.
Yeah.
She was in the National Broadcasting Association Lecture Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see her, and she offered me a contract. She said, you can make three times the money you're making teaching school. She said, you need to take this book around the country and read your poems the way you read it. The book at Arthur Luncheon.
Yeah.
So at the end of that year, I left West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And some people wanted to say I'd been fired, but I wasn't fired. I got a contract.
Yeah.
But I chose to try my hand at that lecture. Yeah, I wasn't sorry. I met my husband.
Yeah.
I got married. And although my career seemed almost at a peak then, it was just beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was just beginning. And again, it was a result of my having come south.
And so how long then was it before, I think it was in 49 you went to Jackson State?
I got married and went back to North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
My husband and I were married in North Carolina. And I went back to Livingston College that fall afterwards.
That fall.
And when I went back, I left on maternity leave. And I never went back there anymore.
Uh-huh.
I had two children. I was expecting the third child. When I left High Point, I had tried, I wouldn't go back to Livingstone. I didn't want to go back over there. Tried to get a job at A&T in Greensboro. I tried several places in North Carolina. And I learned that my master's degree would not earn me as much as $300 a month teaching school.
Wow.
But I had decided that that's what I wanted to make. That's what I needed in my family to help my husband who was disabled.
Right.
He had come home 50% disabled.
Uh-huh.
And he had a little stipend. His compensation was about $65 a month. And he went out and got a job, I think at Adam Miller's hosiery mill. And they sent for him to come into the VA and ask him, because you see, the Social Security people immediately knew that he was working.
Mm-hmm.
So they called him in and said, do you have a job? Are you working? And he tried to help him and all, but they said, yes or no. He said, he wanted to say he had a part-time job, but when he told him yes, he was working.
Mm-hmm.
They cut his compensation to, instead of 50%, to 10%.
Mm.
And that meant I had to find work somewhere.
Yeah.
I waited around there. He had two children. He didn't have a job. No sooner did he get on the job than he'd have to get off. He couldn't work. And I think once or twice my family had to help us. And his family had to help us. We were living in a house that he had paid for. So all we had to have was little utility and food money, and we couldn't buy clothes.
This was still in North Carolina. Raleigh? In Greensboro?
High Point. One day I was sitting out in the backyard, and I must not have even been presentable. And I was expecting this third child, and I was very depressed. And the doctor who had been my doctor with the second child came by and came up in the yard in the back where I was and asked me how I was doing. My father had already been up there and people had met my father. So the doctor said, why you stay here in this mill town? You're not accustomed to a mill town. Everybody knows you've lived all your life around colleges and universities. He said, there's nothing here for you and nothing for your husband either, not unless you all have plenty of money. Said, having your house and a little car doesn't mean anything. He said, what you need is money. He said, why don't you go nearer your father and his influence can help you get a job. That was the day I turned my face away from High Point. But I didn't go. I think that might have been September. I didn't leave until December. But I have never spent another night in that house. I was expecting the third child, and I knew I couldn't go to work right away. I told my husband when I left that, I'm telling you now, when this child is born, I'm going somewhere and get a job teaching. And I want you to promise me you'll come wherever I am. He said, well, I will, because I can always get a job. He said, but you can't. People had tried to get me to teach grade school in High Point, and I said, but I'm not prepared for that. They said, you got a master's degree. I said, but it wasn't to teach
children.
Yeah,
that's right. What did he do, your husband?
At the time, he had worked in furniture ever since he was 19. He worked for two furniture companies there in High Point. But when he was went to the service and came back and was disabled, he couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. So he tried to work at Adam Millis. He couldn't even do that.
Mm-hmm.
He got a job trying to be a night watchman, and he couldn't stay on that. So when I went to New Orleans to have this third job, he didn't have a job. And when the baby was born, my father had to pay all the expenses and the money my husband sent. Didn't have the money to send me. He said he borrowed $200 once and then somebody robbed him of that. He didn't have any money to send me. So there we were. And I stayed in New Orleans. The baby was born. The same son who's here with me was born on the 26th day of July, 1949. And on the 26th day of September, I went to work at Jackson College.
So in 49 in September, that's where you went.
That's where I went. And you see what I'd had between, really hard times.
Yeah.
I'd had some hard times,
right.
Because my mother said she'd be glad when the baby was born, if nothing more than I'd stop crying.
That was your third child.
Third child.
Yeah.
But I haven't been without a job since.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to stop us there. I'm afraid we're going to have to move because there's so much noise around here that I'm afraid I'm not doing too well. And I wonder if maybe we could go over in the dining room. Okay, so you ended up at Jackson State in the fall of 49.
That's right.
And when did Jubilee come out? That was in...
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. As I said, these grants have helped me so much.
Mm-hmm.
I had been there 3 years when I gave a literary festival for the 75th anniversary of Jackson College. And I invited 11 distinguished black authors to come to that celebration.
That had been in like 52.
1952, in the fall. And I didn't have a budget of more than $1,500 for these 11 people. And the president said he wanted some original poetry written, which I did. I wrote a pageant. I brought Owen Dodson down, who spent 2 weeks and had a play. And then people like Langston Hughes, Honorbone Tomp, Sterling Brown.
All of whom were at Fisk then?
No.
They had already left Fisk.
Honor was at Fisk.
Yeah.
Langston was in New York. Sterling Brown was in Washington at Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Owen Dodson, I think, was at Howard. And Carolyn Stood was in Washington. And Robert Hayden was at Fisk. And Melvin Tolson was at Langston in Oklahoma. And Arabelle Thompson was at Ebony Johnson Publishing House. And a girl named Mary Louise Roman had just won some things and had been in the Ladies' Home Journal. I invited all of them. And I met with so many problems that I said, if I fail, I have to leave here, and if I succeed, I have to leave here. I succeeded with much stress and strain. But then I had heard already in the time I'd been there that the Ford Foundation was giving money from the Fund for the Advancement of Education.
Mm-hmm.
to increase and enhance college teaching. The dean of the college where I was there, Jackson State, had gotten one of those. A man in music got one. And then this third year was coming up, and one of my neighbors was applying. And I wanted to apply. At first, the president balked and said he wasn't going to do anything for me unless I did thus and so with all my family situations, which I told him I wasn't going to do. He wanted me to have my husband committed. He said he's insane. He's been to the war. He's this. And well, my husband, my business was our business, nobody else's. And
right.
We were, and I said, I'm emotionally involved with him. He's the mother, he's the father of my three children. And I don't care what my mother or my father or my neighbors say. What goes on in my house is my business.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether he had any respect for me for saying it or not, but he changed his mind about not recommending me. The man came to interview me, and I was very despondent. I told him if I didn't get away from there or from someplace soon, I was just going to go down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see myself getting anywhere with my creative ability. Nowhere to publish, nothing. And Ford gave me $5,800 to leave there and go do research on Jubilee, go up to Yale, go to the Southern Historical Collection
at
Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. How long did you stay over there?
I stayed over there from July to December. In January, I went to New Haven.
In 43?
No, 50.
I'm sorry, 53?
This is 53.
Uh-huh.
My father died that summer. But he had said to me, you need to bring all your furniture and stuff and store it here and go up there and work on your doctorate. And I told him, they weren't giving me the money for the doctorate. They were giving me the money to enhance me as a teacher. And I was going to use it in research and go up to American Studies. And what I figured was I'd test out the water at Yale and see how it would be if I one could get a doctorate at Yale. Mm-hmm. I had heard a long time before then when I was out in Iowa and working as a research assistant to Luella Margaret Wright. She was Dr. Right, that the North